The name John Hockenberry first registered on my radar back in 1989 when I was a student in journalism school at Berkeley, and my radio professor played an NPR Sound Prints piece called Rooftops of Palestine. That professor, Bill Drummond, also regaled us with stories of his NPR colleague and implanted two images. First, the image of the relentless reporter. In this case, a paraplegic who threaded through the streets of Gaza and ascended tenement stairwells to talk to Palestinians, then squeezed into phone booths to file his dispatches. Second, the image of the consummate storyteller. The narrator who put me in Gaza, a place I'd never been, and gave me the sounds and the squalor and the tragic nobility of the people living there. Over the intervening 20 years, John Hockenberry has worked in public broadcasting and in commercial broadcasting. He has typed out magazine articles, and he has written two books. He has appeared off-Broadway in a one-man play called Spokeman, and he has appeared online in a forum called The Bloggenberry World. He has fathered a set of twins, and then he fathered another set of twins. He has become a distinguished fellow at the MIT Media Lab, and he has become the host of a brand new morning drive time program on public radio called The Takeaway. He is still a relentless reporter and a consummate storyteller. And he's one who bends the media to his will instead of the other way around. Please welcome John Hockenberry.
You know, I always think about the guys who put up those ramps. And I figure that I owe it to them to give you, like, the dramatic entrance. I mean, everybody else comes up the stairs, but, you know, I got this, like, fabulous platform. Thank you so much, Constance. It's great to be here. I mean, I will say my experience differs a little bit from Connie's, and that is when I told my mother that I was speaking at the Nieman Fellowship Center for the Conference on Narrative Journalism, sponsored by Harvard. My mother said, what's Harvard? Thought we get the important stuff out of the way right off at the top here. The Media Lab is an interesting place to think about journalism and narrative journalism and multi-platforms in journalism. I think the Nieman Foundation has a long, a long tradition of thinking about traditional journalism, and I think there's a kind of an interesting sort of grappling with the same problem from very different ends if we think about one end of Cambridge, the Nieman Foundation, and the Media Lab at the other end. I'll be thrilled to share with you some of my experiences at the Media Lab and also with this new radio show. But I want to alert you to this Tech Review article that I wrote that came out in January that described a little bit of my experiences at NBC. It is not necessarily relevant to what we'll be talking about today, although I will talk about how certain kinds of narratives intervene in a place like NBC, which is owned by another corporation called General Electric, particularly in a time of war. So there may be some of that material that I refer to, although I'll probably have a much different take on it in this particular presentation. I also want to talk about the difference between public media and commercial media. Because I think when we think about narrative journalism, I mean, I think about it in the broadest sense. I mean, when Connie says it's the application of the techniques of fiction to nonfiction, I mean, that's sort of you know, territory that's been well honed by, you know, the likes of Judy Miller and Jason Blair. And And while I think there are techniques in fiction writing, and I've done fiction writing, that can be applied to nonfiction, I think Connie has enumerated them very well, there's also a kind of getting to the bottom of things quality to exploring these narratives that has always been a tension in journalism. I'm working right now in the process of developing this program called The Takeaway with the New York Times. We have a partnership with the New York Times. I love my colleagues at the New York Times. The institution of the New York Times could not be more different than the institution of NPR, the institution of NBC. In many ways, these journalistic behemoths have a kind of a internal culture that is a narrative in and of itself. But there's something on, it's been interesting just sort of thinking about this quality of narrative journalism, or where does the narrative fit in journalism. In my experience with the New York Times, there's something on the front page of NewYorkTimes.com or NYTimes.com called backstory. Backstory, I think, is probably another way of talking about some kind of other narrative, some other sort of plot line that is responsible for generating a particular story. You know, backstory is something you hear about in editorial rooms a lot when they describe, you know, what's the backstory of the character. Maybe the front story is, you know, Brent Favre throwing passes. The backstory is something that might have to do with his dad who died, you know, when he was in the Super Bowl, those kinds of things. Backstory for the New York Times seems to be particularly pointed. What backstory is on NYTimes.com is an interview with a New York Times reporter. And on some level, it's just basically an audio realization of the reporter describing what it is they did. And in many ways, it covers, I mean, it almost excruciatingly covers the same ground that the paper prints in the story. Which is raises the question, begs the question, why would we call this backstory? And when I was presented with the idea, we've been doing some of these backstory concepts in the piloting of this program, and I did a couple last week, and we talked with some great reporters about what they were doing. And what was completely clear, utterly and completely clear, is that we could talk about anything with the New York Times reporter except about the backstory. That is to say, the sources that produced the material, the names of those sources, any motives they might have had of putting that sort of stuff on the air. This was a comfort zone, or this was a place that constituted a discomfort zone in every sense for the people at the New York Times. And it's not, you know, common to them. Reporters don't really like to show the backstory. I mean, it's just not something that there's an upside to. And either that's because the backstory is kind of proprietary to the reporter and constitutes a network of sources that they don't necessarily want to be public, or it actually constitutes some kind of hidden agenda. We're taught to think in journalism that there is what they tell you, and particularly in the time when journalism schools turn out three times, or schools of communication turn out three or four times more people in public relations than in journalism, we're taught to think that the line that you're given is not only not the real story, but is an invitation to dig deeper and to find out what's actually behind the press release or the headline or the motivation. If you're the Fox News Network, you know, your invitation is to determine exactly what in the headline on the so-called mainstream media is actually a deconstruction of what we know to be the liberal conspiracy to take over America and to destroy civilization as we know it. Again, but that's a narrative. The Fox Network is built on a narrative that was deliberately constructed and created by Roger Ailes, who's a genius in broadcasting, which basically said, in the era when the Soviet Union is no longer our enemy and the narrative of the evening news is no longer, have the nukes been launched, who's ahead in the Cold War, that narrative that motivated for a generation, two generations really of the post-war era, why we needed to sit down and watch the evening news on television, when that's over, got to create a new narrative. The narrative Ailes created was, they're coming. We know who they are, and we're watching it for you. And it's worked. Bill O'Reilly is the highest rated program in news and information on cable. A lot of the so-called mainstream media have struggled to compete, largely because they really don't understand this narrative role. I mean, in many ways, you see the networks kind of struggling, well, but we're the real journalists. They're just something else. Which only, I mean, what is Fox's response to that? You can see it. Their response is, well, now, of course, they would say that, wouldn't they? We're watching it. Don't worry. We're watching it. Again, it inflames their narrative. It informs their narrative. It fits into their narrative, while the mainstream media kind of, we're the authority. This survey proves that we're the authority. We're balanced. No, they said that. Oh, we can't say balanced. They ruin balance. So, you know, as the mainstream media sort of struggles to embrace a narrative that is both plausible and generates an audience, which thereby generates revenue, this whole notion of where narrative fits in journalism has changed quite a lot. I'm going to play something here in a second, but I'm going to begin with a story that comes directly out of the piloting that we're doing for this program called The Takeaway. We decided to do some election specials that were broadcast in some markets around the country. Probably most of you didn't hear them. And we had no resources, we had no staff at the time. And the idea was, and the people at WNYC in New York came to us and said, what we'd like you to do is to do the sort of the interactive piece of the election. You know, it's like the interactive, but people are voting. That's the interactive piece of the election. I mean, they're going and voting. They go, what interactive piece are you talking about? Well, you know, this kind of the online sort of interactive piece, you know, you'll figure it out. Which basically was, you know, some kind of bloggy and email-y sort of comment page kind of thing. And we all know what that is. It's Cafferty file, if you watch CNN. I mean, it's like an old guy sitting there reading emails, you know. You know, this, you know, I've been in this profession for a long time, and just that, as the place to end up, as kind of like the imitation Cafferty file, or the smarter Cafferty file, no, this was not an appealing prospect. So we had to think hard about what it is we were going to do in this so-called interactive piece. So my colleagues and I were sitting around, and we were talking about, you know, this notion of exit polls. What is it? I mean, what's the backstory of exit polls? Well, first of all, the one fact that we knew is that no one had ever seen an exit pollster. And there were people in the room who had been covering elections for, I mean, I covered Jimmy Carter's campaign. And none of us had ever seen an exit pollster, ever. Have you seen one? Do you know anyone who's been polled? No, none of us knew anyone. So you go, great, we're getting into Ailes territory here. Yeah. Exit polls, sure. There's a narrative right there. Conspiracy theory, narrative. You know, it's just leaking, reeking of narrative. So we had that going for us. Then we said to ourselves, well, you know, exit polling information is actually, it's an absurdity because you're basically asking the same questions or a lot of the same questions that are on the ballot. And the information is only valuable between the time that you talk to the person who's voted and they count the votes that night. So that means exit polling information has no relevance. It's a perishable information. It's like it's a day later, it's of no value. Now, maybe some broad demographic issues. I mean, it's actually been interesting in this particular campaign. The exit polling information has been the source of how the racial divide within the Democratic electorate, Democratic Party electorate, is getting more and more polarized. That's been pretty interesting. But by and large, the exit polling information has no value the next day. So what do you do about that? Well, we said, you know, maybe we'll just make up something and we'll call it America's Exit Poll, which is basically just like an email address where people can send us emails. But the key to making it something distinctive was all about this sort of idea of narrative. And the question that we asked people is like, okay, if you voted in any of the primaries or in any of the, you know, and this was something we were going to do on February 5th where 22 states voted. If you voted in any of the primaries, you can either SMS us by cell phone, you can email us, You can send video or audio content to us. You can call a number and send a voicemail in that will be converted to text by an internet application called Spinbox. And we'll just keep track of all of that. And basically the question is, how did you make up your mind to vote for whatever candidate you voted for? How did you make up your mind? And we had to sort of test this out. So we contacted a lot of voters who had voted in the early primaries in South Carolina and in Iowa and in New Hampshire. And when we asked the question, people said to us, oh, well, you know, I voted for Hillary because healthcare is really important in America. And I think that more and more Americans think that healthcare is important in America. And I said, you know, no. Because the person in response to the question was actually responding like a television pundit. So I was asking them, how did you make up your mind? And they were going, hi, I'm Chris Matthews, you know. And I said, well, you know, that's really interesting about healthcare. That's great, and maybe that's true. But actually, what I want to know is what you were doing in the moment that you made up your mind. I mean, what room were you in? You know, who were you with? Who were you talking to? What was that about? What happened? Just take me through the few moments when you actually made up your mind. Oh, well, I didn't know you were interested in that. And we got these stories, you know, one at a time. As soon as you gave people permission to tell the story of how they made up their mind, they told the story of, like, I got up, I was going to vote for Obama, but then I saw my 3-year-old daughter, and I said, you know, how am I going to face her? And so I took her with me to the voting booth, and we came around the corner, and then there were some friends of ours, and they were the first African-American family on our block. You know, little details like this, and this growing drama, and I got to the end, so who'd you vote for? Oh, my God! You know, I pulled the lever for Hillary. Oh, that was a great story, you know. And it was devoid of any demographic meaning. It had no sort of broad sociological significance. You couldn't turn it into a research tool. But the first one of those we played on the air during these pilots, the servers started to break down. I mean, they literally fell apart because we got thousands and thousands of people going, oh, if you're interested in this, well, let me tell you the story of this and this and this and this. And we had story after story after story all night of what people did to make up their mind. And it was this mix of issues and emotion and circumstance and accident and something they saw on Fox or something they saw that Keith Olbermann said or who knows. But that was democracy in action. All those individual little stories, and beneath the broad demographics, this attempt to get at the truth, you know, which the exit polls supposedly do and of course are always wrong, it was these individual random stories that seemed to have so much more validity, so much more significance, and seemed to much more plausibly represent what actually goes on in an election, in a democratic election that's actually contested where people really want to participate. But you got none of that information until you switched on the permission to say, you know, I want to hear that story. And then people were dying to tell that story. And then it kind of built on itself. You know, what does that mean for you? I don't know. I have no idea. But, you know, what's the takeaway for that? I don't know. But it certainly taught me that there is a story at work in almost every sort of event, every sort of journalistic event. And the question is, how do you find it? And then how do you give permission for it to rise to the top? And then more importantly, and this is what I'm going to talk about for most of the rest of this presentation, is how do you keep it from actually concealing the truth rather than enhancing the truth? And that's something I have a fair bit of experience with. But let's begin with something I want to play for you. I will say that the reason I know something about narrative, and the reason I know something about narrative in a broad sense, relates to something very sort of specific about me. Connie did a fabulous introduction. I'm very much grateful to her for that. But you could imagine this one. He grew up in a happy suburban home, and then one day, on a road in Pennsylvania, the worst happened.
I didn't want to live after I couldn't walk again.
But he came back. He pulled himself up by his bootstraps and became a journalist, going to stairwell after stairwell.
I'm going to have to haul myself up these stairs.
And getting to the top of American journalism. Tonight, the story of John Hockenberry. Ladies and gentlemen, well, there you go. And of course, you know, my experience in television is basically been finding ways of taking people whose lives are filled with, you know, accidents and this and that, and cramming them into these boxes of, there was this happy moment, and then there was this really, really sad moment, and then the moment started to get happier, and finally triumph over adversity. You know. I mean, this is the narrative. You're familiar with this narrative? You know about this narrative? Do you actually buy books that are about this narrative? It's like 1,000 little pieces, you know? That's fiction, turns out, you know. Love or consequence, fiction. But it's a triumph over adversity narrative that I suspect conceals more than it reveals. But let's listen to this. This is a story from that period of time when Bill Drummond was learning what a lunatic I was at the University of California, Berkeley School. Bill Drummond and I were colleagues at National Public Radio. He was a State Department correspondent when I was a Middle East correspondent. This is a story from the immediate aftermath of what we call the first Gulf War, but what people in the Middle East call the second Gulf War, that took place in 91 when the U.S. So-called liberated Kuwait.
It was a big enough operation early this morning on the only bridge over the raging Zap River. Villagers from Jakarta were packing loaves of bread into bags for the refugees. These villagers have been delivering 100,000 loaves per day to the estimated 200,000 people up on a mountain. Most of the bread is hoisted onto the shoulders of a local Turkish Kurd and walked up a steep mountain trail to Uzumlu, the village where the 200,000 have been living for the past 4 or 5 days. The deeply moving but genteel parade of bread-toting relief workers was overwhelmed, though, that the refugees started coming down the mountain shortly after noon. It was a trickle at first, and then a torrent. One travels over steep ridge after steep ridge to get to Uzumlu, and today each ridge revealed another solidly packed wave of muddy people walking towards some new temporary destination. They didn't know where they were going. Babies cried, children played games, noses ran, and other things ran. Miserable children crouched behind bushes, relieving themselves of the effects of almost a week in the open, drinking muddy water and eating nothing but bread. Everyone was carrying something, one man his brother, two bedrolls, some tent poles, and a portable cassette player. Behind him, his children dutifully toddled, one with the stove, another with the teapot. The children's bare feet made a sucking sound in the cold mud. Walking through this crowd of people, easily more dense than a rush hour mob on Park Avenue, but in this case, stretching for many kilometers, one heard people mumbling and shouting about Saddam Hussein. He was blamed for the children's misery, for the rain, for the mud. Ahmed from Dahuk said Kurds, like all Iraqi citizens, have lost something from the war, but it is fear that moves them to leave now. The whole city of Dahuk is walking into Turkey, he said.
To kill us, that is the reason we are escaped from it. You know Saddam Hussein, the man who is, he can kill 1 million like smoke cigarettes.
Khalid, a civil engineer from Dahuk, said he had a question for George Bush and why freedom for 1.5 million Kuwaitis counted more than the freedom of 5 million Kurds. The war, he said, was lost by George Bush because the Kurds are not free.
I am sure that my home is destroyed and everything is stolen by Saddam soldiers and his company. And American, English, French know very well this thing. What he do in Kuwait, he's doing now in Iraq, in his city.
Khalid's sister pulls back her veil for a moment and points to an ugly scar she received. Roll her talking in Arabic, I say, it's from an American bomb, she says, as she wearily gets up to continue her walk down the mountain. A small riot breaks out over the arrival of a donkey with packets of shoes to hand out to children. A Turkish soldier fires in the air to control things. Khalid's sister cringes visibly. The scar on her face is clearly not the only one she will carry from this war. This is John Hockenberry on the Iraqi-Turkish border.
All right, so I don't know how much of that you could hear. But in general, the idea there was to present a portrait of refugees streaming out of Kurdistan who'd been chased by American helicopters at the conclusion of the war. And and to try to tell the story of the human beings who were making their way along these horribly muddy, desperate roads to refugee camps that didn't exist. And the problem, though, is that what's actually going on in all of that audio is that as these Kurds are streaming out of Iraq, there's this one guy on a donkey who's going the other direction, and that was me. And the questions that all of these Kurdish refugees had as they would encounter us on the road and we would have to move over is, you know, first of all, why are you on the donkey? And secondly, why aren't you carrying some supplies to the refugees? And my the person who owned the donkey, who was with me, who was helping me up the hill, because it was the only way to go anywhere in this zone, would say, well, this fellow here, he can't walk because my wheelchair wasn't anywhere with me. And so he's riding on the donkey. And then it was, oh my God, what, you turn around immediately, you must go back. You know, I had to explain that I was actually a reporter. And so all the voices that you hear in that story are people who responded not to wanting to tell something to George Bush or wanting to respond to a reporter, but who it took many minutes, 15, 20 minutes, a half an hour in some cases, to get them to believe that, no, actually, it was okay. I wasn't going to die here. I really want to hear your story, and please just sit down and tell me. And so there's a degree of sort of intimacy and kind of, are you going to be all right? All right, I'll tell you about George Bush, but then get the hell out of here, you know, kind of thing. And okay, you can see my daughter's scar. I mean, pull the veil back and you can see the scar on her face, but just then get the hell out of here, kind of thing. And the problem for me as a journalist is the only story that is of any relevance is just the people streaming out of Iraq. The fact that I, you know, get to the edge of the Zap River on the Turkish-Kurdish border and, you know, there's no way to go. There's no walking. There's no way to roll in a wheelchair on any of these roads that go straight up the side of a mountain. And, you know, having to figure out how I'm going to explain to the NPR accounting department how I'm expensing the donkey. You think that's easy? And the donkey feed, you know, and the tip. What is the tip for a donkey? I discovered it's actually $60 for the donkey and a $20 tip. It's probably more now, okay? But the question really for me was, I mean, part of that was really important. Part of that story was important. Part of the motives in the people talking to me were different from the motives of other people talking to me. And there was a particular point where a couple of families just took me off the donkey and we all went up and had this sort of meal together, and they went and they said, this is insane for you to be going on the donkey. What we'll do is we'll get people from all the families of all the cities that we know and we'll bring them to you. And of course, being an American, I just thought that was cheating. So I tried to argue against it, but that I wasn't in the best position because I was sitting on the donkey. But all of these factors weighed into every voice you heard on that story. And the question for me always, and that was just one example, was where does my narrative intersect with the broad sort of news narrative? And in my case, because the wheelchair is sort of slightly content neutral. I mean, it's not as though, like, there's an advantage to people in wheelchairs to meet, you know, some sort of cash payment goes to people in wheelchairs if I talk about wheelchairs on the air, you know, which would not be the case if I was doing like an insider trading story, you know, where, or if I was doing a story on a particular stock and I happen to own all the stock. There's an internal narrative to my ownership of the stock that is possibly relevant to the outside. But nevertheless, it had a very strong influence on how the story came out. The same is true in, you know, almost every sort of institutional mission in journalism that, you know, the Fox Network attempts to out as being liberal, or maybe some other advocacy groups attempt to out as being corporate in some way. When I was at NBC, they were just beginning the process of what's called Six Sigma, which is a process whereby people were taught the sort of internal General Electric culture of how to think of everything in terms of shareholder value. And they would say this explicitly. You would have meetings, and everything that you did had to be related to shareholder value. That the only narrative that was relevant at all inside General Electric and ultimately inside NBC was how you were contributing to the value of General Electric's stock price for the investors. And I mean, yes, there were journalistic problems with this, but this was not a radical idea. People didn't go, that's insane, I'm quitting. People went, you know, I want to be employed here tomorrow, and so we'll just see how we kind of accommodate ourselves with this. And various sorts of accommodations were made. At the time of 9/11, General Electric was one of the top 10 defense contractors. As it became clear that we were headed towards a war with Iraq, an invasion of Iraq, we also had stepped up training sessions, which I describe a little bit in the tech review piece as being a little like kind of Maoist sort of self-criticism sessions where you would go in and you would sit down and they'd show you a movie about somebody using the corporate credit card like improperly, and then you'd sit around and you'd go, I thought about doing that once. God, I hate myself. You know. And you would do this for an afternoon, and then they would give you instructions on how not to use the credit card, although why you would need instructions for that, I don't know. And at one of these sessions, as we were leading up to the 2003 war, I and a couple of other colleagues noted that, you know, is it possibly, I mean, yes, it's wrong to take, you know, napkin ring gifts from a source, and it's probably wrong to buy them dinner, and it's certainly wrong for me to benefit in some way from a story that I do, but I mean, what are we to make of the fact that General Electric appears to have a contract for power generation in Iraq that exceeds the size of the news division in budget line? And I mean, how are we to disclose that on the air? I mean, shouldn't people who listen to NBC News, particularly our war coverage, understand that GE has a contract for power generation in Iraq that is more expensive and potentially more lucrative than anything in the news division? And I remember the standards and practices person said, as we proposed this idea, huh. Wow. You know, I just don't see how what we do as journalists relates to that at all. I mean, we're covering the war. They're making generators. I said, well, but isn't that part of the, I mean, don't, maybe it doesn't affect us. Maybe we aren't changing our reporting. Maybe we aren't like, you know, doing a, like generators corner segment on nightly news, or talking about how, you know, people love GE light bulbs in Basra, shouldn't listeners and viewers understand that this is a part of our relationship? No, it's crazy. It has nothing to do with it. Now, I mean, I don't think, and I have enough respect for my colleagues at NBC, I don't think that the content in any explicit way was affected. But it's absolutely a disservice to journalistic consumers not to understand that this narrative is in play. And so, in many ways, as journalists, particularly if you're working for institutions of one kind or another that have all kinds of different agendas, you're asked to basically cop to a narrative that maybe nobody wants you telling directly to the consumers of your sort of storytelling. And it's an important element. And in content terms, in context terms, the fact that GE has a relationship with the Coalition Provisional Authority to do power generation in Iraq as a kind of backstory to NBC's war coverage is identical to the fact that I have this wheelchair problem that completely transforms and changes the way in which I get my stories. Now, does it affect anything you hear on the air? No, but it's probably meaningful in some way, and you can't predict how meaningful to people who are listening to your stories on the air. You know, There's a movie that many of us saw growing up in the 1980s, or coming of age as adults in the 1980s, called Risky Business. Do you know this movie? You do know this movie? Yeah, you're old enough to know this movie, I'm afraid. And it is about how a young man impresses the admissions committee for Princeton University to overlook his mediocre grades by starting essentially a prostitution ring for friends and neighbors in his New Jersey neighborhood, or Chicago neighborhood, Chicago suburban neighborhood. And this was, you know, very funny. And in fact, the value conveyed by this piece of fiction was that starting a prostitution ring, you know, is pretty entrepreneurial. Not bad. And when Tom Cruise gets into Princeton and his dad is happy, everybody's thrilled. You know. On Tuesday, you have no idea where I'm going. The New York Post delivered an editorial saying that basically the governor of New York needed to resign immediately so that, quote, we not be in the state of New York preoccupied with this sordid affair. Valid argument. Certainly, among others, the governor of New York heeded that argument, perhaps, or came to the same conclusion on his own and resigned.